PFK Local Board 2023.
You just heard from two candidates for KPFK's Local Station Board. All candidate statements and information about the voting process are at elections.pacifica.org.
Welcome to Gray Zone Radio. On this episode, we'll listen to a conversation between Max Blumenthal, Aaron Mate, and special guest Michael Tracy about the Trump indictments. For more information about the Gray Zone, you can visit us on the web at www.thegrayzone.com. Now, let's take a listen to the conversation about the Trump indictments.
Michael Tracy, independent journalist who writes on Substack. Michael, welcome.
Hello. I'm biting my tongue about the RFK Jr. stuff. I don't want to return to that discussion, but maybe I should just bite my tongue.
Let's just say you were skeptical of RFK Jr. from the start.
I'll just kind of say one quick thing.
Sure, go ahead.
If his thinking or if his logic is so obviously, you know, disordered or incoherent on this subject, is it really that much of a stretch to think that he might have arrived at other positions which you might circumstantially agree with by a similarly kind of incoherent thought process? I mean, there's no real tangible, at least as I've seen it, kind of a through line between his views on things. But everybody is just so desperate to say, oh, thank you for raising this issue that I really agree with, when it doesn't – I mean, you have to kind of step back and – analyze the candidacy as a whole to see if you're just being pandered to. And I don't know, I hesitate to reward pandering.
To me, I've seen it happen a lot. People get duped very easily. And I like to believe that he was duped on this issue. And
how many times does the guy have to be duped? He's 70 years old. He told Glenn Greenwald, oh yeah, I got duped by Russiagate. And then, and then Glenn's like, oh yeah, isn't that wonderful that he got duped by Russiagate in his late 60s, but now at 70, he finally saw the light. And we're supposed to be impressed by that and view that as a credential for him running for president, not as a demerit. It's a merit.
Right. So to be a duped the by problem Russiagate, is,
not a demerit.
Right. Michael Tracy started this commentary by saying, can I say something real quick?
Okay, yeah, let's move on.
Which is the biggest lie you've ever told. No. I'll say real quick, in 10 seconds, I think he, RFK Jr.'s in a way playing a positive role by just making this debate possible and allowing us to get some traction here. If he wasn't there.
I'm
not saying based on what he's saying. I'm just saying
it's predicated on a total myth, which has to do with his family lineage. That's the only reason he's been running in the first place. It's not because he's like a brilliant philosopher king that he figured out all the remedies for fixing our ailing.
Michael, he has a track record. He has a listen. This is the last debate I want to have because I'm really He has a track record as an attorney who has done something. It's not just this. Anyway, but listen, I think we should move on because we brought you on to discuss.
Bring you back to talk about that. But
I'm supposed to be interviewing myself at some point, so maybe I should just.
We got about 20 minutes. wait, stop. We have 20 minutes.
Okay, let's go.
Michael Tracy, your thoughts on the latest Trump indictment? Just go.
Yeah, I mean, the first thought is that if you read it, it's an incredibly zealous criminalization. Outright, unabashed criminalization of what had previously been understood universally to just be ordinary political speech and political conduct. Now, obviously, Trump attempting to do what he did in the aftermath of the 2020 election and contest the results in a variety of ways was not ordinary as a whole. But the actions that he took in isolation, meaning to criticize the Secretary of State of Georgia, or to attempt to express certain political grievances around the manner of election administration in Arizona or Wisconsin or whatever, those on their own are not particularly extraordinary political acts or instances of political speech. But now Jack Smith, the prosecutor, has concocted this overarching theory that posits that all that conduct taken in totality could be seen as now a criminal conspiracy. And that really is an alarming aspect of this that's, you know, on a kind of broad-based level, really ought to give people pause.
And one of the things you pointed out was that we've been primed for years now to believe that Trump committed incitement and that he would be charged for that. But yet, as you point out, that charge, incitement, is not mentioned at all in the indictment.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you remember this phony baloney January 6th House Committee, Special Committee on January 6th that was co-chaired by Liz Cheney, put out a report in December of last year where they meticulously and tediously went through every last little detail of what they claim transpired on January 6th and in the run-up. And their ultimate recommendation, even though they had no power to do so, it's not like Congress authorizes these committees to make criminal referrals, but they claim that they had the power to issue a criminal referral. And one of the crimes that they referred, quote unquote, to the Justice Department was incitement of insurrection, because there is a federal statute in the, there is a provision of the federal criminal code that does make a crime the incitement or the commission of an act of insurrection or rebellion. So that was what was proposed as what something that the Justice Department could charge Trump with by the January 6th House Committee. Now, Jack Smith has not gone along with that. So he had the option, in other words, Jack Smith, of formalizing and ratifying this idea that January 6th constituted an insurrection and Trump was the insurrectionist in chief, but he chose not to. And yet that's not going to make anyone question whether this term that's been propagandistically inundating us for the past 2.5 years actually is accurate, even though, you know, in the one test that would have actually been constituted some kind of adversarial format for adjudicating whether insurrection is the right term, the prosecutor balked and decided not even to go with that statute.
So what's in the indictment that you find so objectionable? I read some, as I said, I've been on the road, so I haven't had a chance to read the indictment. I've been reading a lot of children's books to my kid, however. And so I've read some of the parts you've screenshotted. At one point,
that's all you need. Just
well, you did hit on some very curious passages. One which says that Trump knew that the election had not been stolen from him, and he had been informed that it had been not stolen from him, and yet he proceeded anyway to tell his followers that it had been stolen. So how did they know that Trump knew that, and where is the crime there? What else are you finding in the indictment that's objectionable?
Yeah, so one of the novel theories that they've concocted in order to prosecute Trump on these grounds is they assert, meaning the prosecutors, assert that Trump knowingly lied, meaning he knew that his claims about January 6th or about election fraud or about the impropriety of the election results, he knew them to be false and yet made the claims anyway, with the theory being that that transfers Trump's speech outside the realm of political speech and into fraud, which therefore makes it criminalizable in the way that it wouldn't be if it was just Trump making a contested political claim and then, you know, others disagreeing with it or making their own contested political claim to counter it. Now, there's no evidence cited that Trump knowingly lied about anything that he said regarding January 6th, other than they cite Trump being told or informed that what he was saying was apparently untrue or allegedly untrue by members of the Justice Department, by certain of his campaign advisors, by Mike Pence, by a whole gamut of other people, that somehow is meant to be probative of Trump knowing that what he was saying was false. Now, even if a politician does knowingly make a false statement, it's unclear, very unclear, whether that could constitute a criminal act. Otherwise, you're criminalizing politicians lying, which is kind of a regular occurrence. But even beyond that, I mean, Trump's conduct doesn't really make a whole lot of sense as I see it if he did not, on some level, genuinely believe what he was saying. Otherwise, why would he have taken such extreme action? I mean, do you get the impression that Trump secretly knew all along that there was no election fraud in the 2020 election? That's not the impression I ever got.
Well, if Mike Pence says something to you, it has to be true.
Yeah, but that's the novel theory that the prosecutors have gone with. And interestingly, Jack Smith, before he became the special counsel overseeing these dueling Trump investigations, so Jack Smith, remember, also has presided over this classified documents case where he resurrected the Espionage Act to charge Trump. Jack Smith, prior to November of 2022, was on loan from the U.S. to the International Criminal Court at The Hague, where he was the lead special prosecutor for the Kosovo Tribunal. So the U.S. allowed for several years, for actually several decades, it's allowed for U.S. personnel to be used in international criminal court proceedings pursuant to Kosovo, because it's one of the exceptions they carved out that permitted U.S. engagement with the International Criminal Court. And Jack Smith, lo and behold, was the person who was in that role. And in international law, international human rights law, as they put it, whatever you might want to say about it, at the very least, it's pretty much universally acknowledged that there aren't a whole lot of binding precedents, meaning you kind of make it up as you go along. It's not like you have a constitution. It's not like you have a U.S. constitution that bars you from taking certain prosecutorial action because it would violate the Fourth Amendment or the Fifth Amendment, et cetera. It's basically just at the whim of the prosecutor or at the authority that's in power. And that's what Jack Smith had been doing for the preceding 4 years before he was brought over by Merrick Garland to take on these Trump investigations. Hence, the kind of sprawling, freewheeling creativity that Jack Smith has used to go after Trump on January 6th, and then also the documents case where they decided that for the first time ever, a dispute over the retention of presidential records was going to be swiftly transformed into a criminal matter, whereas there really had been no expectation that was even going to possibly take place prior to
similar with the hush money payments case too. That's also the first time that legal theory, whatever it is in that case about Trump classifying his payments to Stormy Daniels in a certain way, that now constitutes a felony as opposed to a lower charge.
Exactly. I mean, so what does that tell you? If we're now at the third, and we're going to get a fourth, but we're now we're at number three of the indictments that are predicated on the construction of these elaborate, convoluted new legal theories that were created solely to apply to Trump. Like, it's not as though Trump robbed a bank or something and then was charged with the statute that would ordinarily govern the robbing of a bank or be used to prosecute people who rob banks, right? No, they've manufactured or confabulated brand new legal theories in now three separate instances specifically to charge Trump. And the New York case is another example of that. They literally assert in that case that Trump defrauded himself by entering into his own corporate ledgers a description of payments that he had made for the made to Stormy Daniels to allegedly hush up his affair with Stormy Daniels. So he defrauded not the state of New York, not taxpayers, not the campaign finance board of New York or the Federal Campaign Finance Commission. Trump defrauded himself. I mean, look at the indictment. It sounds crazy when I'm describing it, but that's what they did. And this is a clear trend with the January 6th indictment this week, probably being the most dramatic example of a brand new legal theory developed basically out of thin air for no purpose other than to target Trump.
Yeah. And this comes after they framed him as a Russian agent and consumed his presidency with that. And then when they realized there was nothing there, then they pivoted to accusing him of obstruction of the investigation into the fake claim he was a Russian agent, which again, also they had nothing there either, because Robert Mueller, who investigated all this, declined to even make a call on whether or not he committed obstruction. He just put it out there that he might have committed obstruction. These are some possible cases. And this was part of a multi-year campaign, as you pointed out, long before January 6th happened, where Democrats were openly calling for Trump's prosecution. In fact, I believe they were basically calling for his impeachment since the day he took office, if not before. And
pretty much,
it's like we're expected to forget all that context every time one of these new indictments is handed down.
Didn't Kamala Harris criticize the Garland Justice Department for not indicting Trump and not building these cases to prevent him from running again? I just
pulled up a clip last night of Kamala Harris
I got it right here.
Yeah, what she said. This is when she was running for president in her, you know, hilariously failed presidential primary campaign, where
zero delegates.
She was criticizing the Trump Justice Department for allegedly interfering in political affairs, or rather, the Trump White House interfering in the Trump Justice Department's conduct of criminal investigations. And yet she, Kamala Harris, was saying that it's unmissable, or it's unmistakable, or it's inevitable that the Trump that Trump would have to be prosecuted once he leaves office. Meaning she was
doing... Let's watch that clip, Michael. Let's watch that clip.
Let's talk about now the former special counsel Robert Mueller's appearance in front of Congress last week. When asked whether or not the president could be charged with a crime after leaving office, his answer was yes. Senator Harris, you've criticized President Trump for interfering with the Justice Department. And just last month, you said if you were elected president, your Justice Department would, quote, have no choice and should go forward with the obstruction of justice charges against former President Trump. Why is it okay for you to advocate for the Justice Department to prosecute somebody, but President Trump, not him?
Well, I would never direct the Department of Justice to do whatever it believes it should do. But look, we all watched his testimony. I read the report. There are 10 clear incidents of obstruction of justice by this president. And he.
It's not true, by the way. The report lays out 10 possible cases. But and this is the part that everybody, you know, Kamala Harris included, forgets, is the Mueller team even offered the counterarguments as to why it would not be obstruction of justice. And one of the points they made was that, well, he wasn't guilty of the underlying crime of being a Russian conspirator. So how can you obstruct an investigation into something you're not guilty of? That was one of the arguments that Mueller even acknowledged, but we're supposed to forget.
Yeah.
He needs to be held accountable.
Go ahead, Michael.
Oh, yeah, because remember, the thinking at the time was that but for this memo sitting somewhere in the Justice Department that gave an opinion as to the ability of the Justice Department to charge a sitting president, Trump would clearly be charged because he was so clearly guilty of a vast number of crimes outlined allegedly in the Mueller report. So that was Kamala Harris saying that basically on principle, it was necessary to prosecute Trump. It wasn't even necessarily contingent there on what was in the Mueller report. She uses the Mueller report kind of as a pretext, or the claims of obstruction kind of as a pretext. But then 4 years later, the zeal with which they were saying that Trump needed to be prosecuted given these obstruction offenses or alleged obstruction offenses related to the Mueller investigation are nowhere to be found. They've been forgotten. And Trump is being prosecuted for other stuff because the underlying principle was never about the exact nature of the offense that Trump was alleged to have committed, but it was about the overriding need to prosecute Trump. And then finding a crime that fit the bill.
Right. I mean, Russiagate created the sense that he's some kind of criminal installed by a foreign power and everything flows from there. Even if they couldn't nail him on that, that's the goal.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, I got 5 minutes here. Just a kind of a broader question. So much of this indictment seems to hinge on things Trump said in public. And it doesn't, in my view, meet the standard for judicial or legal precedent on incitement to violence. I don't think, and this has been debated publicly, where even liberal pro-Democratic Party scholars said he didn't go as far as those previously prosecuted for incitement because he didn't directly tell his followers to attack the Capitol. So what kind of precedent does this indictment set for free speech, freedom of assembly, the right to protest, when I don't believe our electoral system is, I question our electoral system. I even question the 2020 election. I mean, so many ballots sent, so many ballots were mailed in. Beyond that, you had the whole cover up of the Hunter Biden laptop, the lies deployed by intelligence officials. I mean, there are so many aspects of rigging that don't relate to voting machines. Just because Lynn Wood came out and made these ridiculous statements about Venezuela controlling the voting machines, the whole Dominion system sham, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't be questioning our electoral system. It doesn't mean that the 2000 election wasn't obviously stolen. I mean, so what precedent does this set for the First Amendment?
Yeah, well, notably, Jack Smith does not bring an incitement charge, despite it having been recommended by the January 6th House Committee, because that would have had much more explicit bearing on the First Amendment. Now, it still has a bearing on the First Amendment, the charges that have been brought, but not in that more direct kind of flagrant sense, because, again, he's sort of bundling up all a whole array of behavior and speech into now what is being alleged to be a criminal conspiracy to defraud the United States or to deprive people of rights. So interestingly, the charge that is brought, and this is kind of the charge that brings together the whole case, is a conspiracy against rights. That's what it's called in the statute book. It derives from a law that was first enacted in 1866 after the Civil War to target armed vigilante groups like the KKK in the Reconstruction South that were going after newly enfranchised blacks and either depriving them of the ability to vote that had been afforded under the 14th Amendment going after them and even coercing them into voting for KKK-backed candidates. That's what one of the sponsors of the legislation way back then said was the purpose of this bill. And if you look at how this statute has been used even in the more recent past, the Department of Justice in its own internal guidelines, and I have them and I'm actually working on a piece now that's almost done that goes through this in some more detail, but this bill has been used largely, or this this criminal statute has largely been used to prosecute perpetrators of, for example, cross burnings on the front lawns of black families, or when black families have been driven out of towns. In other words, it's been used largely for kind of explicit racial violence, because the claim is you can connect that the action taken against the black family to the deprivation of certain rights that are afforded under the Constitution. And so it's pretty vague, but the common practice had been by the Justice Department to use it in those instances. And now they've turned that on its head and used it against Trump as though he is now in the same sort of lineage in questioning or contesting the 2020 election results with cross burnings on the front yards of black families. And so in the connotation of that is pretty obvious. Jack Smith, when he introduced the charges at his press conference on Tuesday night, came out and the first thing he said essentially was that Trump had was guilty of a conspiracy to disenfranchise voters. Now, that suggests that Trump blocked or impeded the ability of voters to vote in the election, which he didn't do. In fact, the 2020 election was had the highest turnout of any election since the year 1900. But now they're kind of inverting that logic and saying that Trump's post-election conduct, questioning the veracity of the results or the submission of electors to Congress, that's now a deprivation of the right of the ability of people to vote. So again, he's twisting and contorting things, meaning Jack Smith is, to apply a set of facts to this alleged criminal violation that nobody really would have been thought was fathomable prior to their determination being made that Trump needed to be prosecuted for January 6th, and so we'll figure something out.
Well, Michael, thanks so much for breaking this down. I have to go. I welcome you all continuing.
Yeah, I'll go for a little while longer if you want.
Sure. Yeah, we can go for a little while longer.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So I'm going to jump off here and thank you all for being with us, though, and for all your support. Thanks for liking the stream and for subscribing. If you're not on our newsletter, sign up. I'll be checking in with you next week. And Aaron and Michael are going to continue the conversation about this the fascist threat to the shining city on the hill of American democracy.
All right, Mac. And I know you can't. I know Mac can only handle so much of my brilliance. That's why he just scurried off. Aaron, let me give you a quick example of what I'm talking about here in terms of how this particular statute has generally been used in the very recent past. I pulled up The 2022 edition of what's called the Department of Justice Journal of Federal Law and Practice was essentially like an internal journal for U.S. attorneys as to how certain statutes ought to be employed. And in 2022, this statute that Trump was charged with, under which Trump was charged, is said to be a civil rights conspiracy statute that was enacted over a century ago in response to acts of racial violence committed by the Ku Klux Klan, and that remains a powerful tool in the government's efforts to combat racially motivated crimes of violence. So that's the kind of offense that it was used in relation to for decades. That was basically the precedent up until this week, because Trump isn't accused of committing any racially motivated violence or any kind of racially inflected offense at all. That's nowhere alleged in the indictment. It's that he committed this more intangible disenfranchisement, allegedly, by taking action that called into doubt the veracity of certain states' election procedure and vote tabulation. So again, it's the point being, it's precedent smashing in a way that all the previous indictments have been precedent smashing, because they haven't used something that is clearly delineated in federal law to go after Trump, because there's nothing available. So they have to, again, do very arduous mental gymnastics to figure out what could be applicable.
And let me ask you about a point that I saw Li Fong made, the journalist Li Fong, who said that, if I understand his argument correctly, because Trump is accused of obstructing a ministerial proceeding or an official proceeding, that charge could be now weaponized against, for example, left-wing activists who disrupt Congress, like Code Pink does all the time, when if there's like some war criminal or evil policymaker speaking, Code Pink will protest during a congressional hearing. Li Fong was saying that under the Trump precedent of this indictment, that could be weaponized against activists like that. Do you agree with that?
Partially, but with the qualifier that January 6th defendants, meaning just regular people who were there at the riot, have already been charged with obstruction of an official proceeding basically since the very moment that the DOJ launched into action in the aftermath of January 6th. So this isn't unique to Trump. But it is notable that Trump is being charged with obstruction of an official proceeding, because if you look at who the DOJ has generally charged with that same offense, it has tended to be people alleged perpetrators who took some sort of action that is claimed to be violent, whether it's they scuffled with police or they bashed through a window or they did something physically improper in their entry to the Capitol. And then that is used as sort of the way to hinge their violation on this obstruction of an official proceeding charge. But this is, to charge it against Trump is novel, because obviously Trump was not physically present in the Capitol. Mm-hmm. And so they're stretching the bounds of that obstruction charge even further and saying that Trump obstructed the proceeding by not doing anything physical, by just, you know, engaging in this alleged conspiracy to question the election results.
All right. Well, listen.
Aaron, in the sentencing phase of these prosecutions of ordinary rioters on January 6th, what the government has had a penchant of doing is that once they're coerced into pleading guilty, meaning these guys who were in the Capitol physically, the government then at the sentencing phase of the proceeding invokes an upward revision of the statutory guidelines to argue for them spending even more time in prison by saying that their conduct in disrupting the official proceeding or obstructing it constitutes a terrorism offense. Mm-hmm. So they've used now this rhetoric of terrorism, and they've used this sentencing upward revision that was founded during the right after 9/11 in the Patriot Act to go after people who, could have just been physically inside the Senate chamber for, 30 seconds. So.
All right. As we start to wrap up, let's have some laughs because you've posted some really funny clips of the media fawning over this indictment, fawning over Jack Smith. Let's start with MSNBC's Chris Hayes.
This is the best. Wait, but Aaron, before we begin, look at Rachel's face as she's doing this speech. Look at Rachel's face as Chris is going through this stirring oration that he clearly like planned ahead of time and found all the right Abraham Lincoln quotes to invoke. Rachel looks at him like he's like he just won a spelling bee in fifth grade or something. Like she's such a proud parent.
Yes. She's so proud of her boy. Yes. Yeah. And look how good he is now. And
also reciting. look at the dramatic camera movement too. It's like they're really building up the theatricality of this.
Action, which is just a personal one, and having covered this, I think, you know, like all of us have, and many of the viewers are in the weeds of it too, is like, right, yes, I'm not crazy.
Yeah.
Like, if this wasn't a crime, nothing is a crime. We watched.
Wait, if this wasn't a crime, nothing is a crime. So if you don't charge Trump under this novel, unprecedented legal theory, then I don't know, like murder is now, that's not a crime. what I mean? According that's what he's saying.
According to Chris Hayes, Trump blurting out kind of incoherent grievances about voting election administration procedure in Wisconsin is the most obvious possible criminal activity that he can possibly fathom in his head.
Yeah.
Which gets to his psychology, frankly.
And again, I mean, I'm pretty sure you could make a criminal case against everybody involved in Russiagate who framed Trump as a Russian agent and, you know, criminalized diplomacy with Russia and fed false claims to the media and to the FBI, definitely weaponized government, definitely misled the public, lied to the public. But I'm not sure, I'm not like 100% sure that it's a crime. It's corrupt and it's, you know, morally depraved, but I'm not 100% convinced it's a crime. And I wouldn't say that murder is not a crime if you can't charge somebody with a Russiagate crime.
Yeah, and when did this assumption come in that any action that you find to be politically objectionable has to therefore also be criminalizable?
Yes.
I mean, Peter Strzok opening the initial Crossfire Hurricane investigation, as the Durham report outlined, by reading a blog post and not even consulting with the officials in the FBI who are supposedly big experts on Russian affairs.
Yeah.
Could that be seen as reckless or negligent enough that could warrant some kind of critical scrutiny? I don't know. It's possible, but at the I'm not going to necessarily leap to that being criminal, because that's a giant step to take.
Yes.
That takes it outside the realm of kind of ordinary political contestation and into the realm of criminal law.
And that's where I thought here a fair remedy was impeachment. This is actually a case where, unlike the first impeachment, which I thought was ridiculous, this impeachment, I thought, had some merit, because Trump did act pretty reckless. He did do something that I think was an abuse of his office, or at least arguable. So I thought impeachment, that was a fair remedy. But that's a political act. This is now using the criminal justice system as a remedy for what he did. And it, as we've talked about, it's not nearly so clear at all, at least not nearly as clear as Chris is making it out to be.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure I quite agree about the second impeachment, not because I find Trump's, or not because I found Trump's conduct to be particularly defensible. I was inundated with right-wing trolls online for months telling me that I was the crazy one by just pointing out the obvious falsity of a huge multitude of Trump statements as to the voting count in Philadelphia, Detroit, Milwaukee. I mean, I actually went through it with a fine-tooth comb just to shut these people up, like empirically, but of course it didn't work. But when they ended up impeaching him in the House, they used articles of impeachment, the text of which actually accused Trump of incitement. I mean, it accused him of these speech infringing offenses that, if translated into criminal law, would be hugely stifling of the First Amendment. And even though it's technically only a political remedy, it's still precedent setting to use speech as an offense in that way. And so even if you did object to Trump's conduct, I'm not sure that the way that they went about punishing it in the form of that impeachment is particularly defensible. Okay. And we see what it's led to now. I mean, they use that as basically a formula to go after Trump in a criminal vein. And now they've gotten their wish.
All right, back to Chris.
Tim, do it on television. We sat at this desk a year ago at the January 6th committee. We knew what he was doing. If that is not a crime, then nothing.
Yeah, I think what he's betraying there is some frustration that nobody else cared about the January 6th hearings except for MSNBC hosts. Like, we sat at the table. We watched. We weren't crazy. We spent all of our time talking about the January 6th hearings, which no one cared about, because who cares? And that's what I think Chris is getting at there.
Yeah, he's complaining about being gaslit. I think that would be the proper term to use, by not every American sharing his monomaniacal fixation on the meaningless minutiae of every little January 6th detail. Like, it's not as though Chris was the only one covering it. Others have covered it. I covered it when it comes up. I covered it at the time, et cetera. But, like, I didn't devote my life to every useless little twist and turn in the whole saga at the direction of Liz Cheney and Benny Thompson, who ran this select committee in the House. Yeah. And that's what Chris is, I guess, retroactively kind of criticizing others for not doing, because that's what his life has revolved around for the past 2.5 years. And now he feels like it's been vindicated because Jack Smith resurrected an 1866 criminal rights, criminal conspiracy statute. All right.
Yes. Whatever. Yeah.
Nothing is a crime. So that part of it is just, like, I find really important and gratifying. Mm. I mean, there's a kind of ballast to it. This, yes, of course, this was corrupt. Of course, this was fraud. Of course, it was a conspiracy to defraud the U.S. We all saw him engage in the conspiracy to defraud the U.S.
Millions of people have gaslit Chris Hayes, and he had the last laugh because Jack Smith validated him. He vindicated him. So, yes, there's a ballast there, as he said. All right, we can make fun of this, but there's another aspect to this which we're going to make more fun of. So here it is.
Second thought I had, it's just about the magnitude of this moment, which I think is just worth taking a second on. I mean, with Donald Trump, lots of things are unprecedented. The first time he was indicted was unprecedented, and the second time he was indicted was unprecedented because of the federal indictment had never come down. This is in canon of American events, January 6th and its aftermath. And the reason is that for 159 years after the cannons fire in Fort Sumter, there is an unbroken chain of peaceful transfer of power. And not only that,
wait, Aaron, the pause. Story of you
experiment
gotta,
is a fight in itself.
You got to start up. You got to start up the dramatic orchestral arrangement to underlay his recitation here. Like, it's like we're some kind of 18th century concert.
But enlighten me here. I'm Canadian. I don't really care about, like, you know, American Civil War history. So when he's talking about the cannons firing on Fort Sumter, is that, what is that? The war for independence? Like, what's he talking
about? No. So that's literally the opening salvo of the U.S., of the American Civil War.
The Civil War, okay.
That was in South Carolina when Confederate soldiers for the first time opened fire, meaning cannon fire, on Union forces who were attempting to prevent South Carolina from seceding from the Union. So that's what he's likening in magnitude.
The QAnon shaman.
Yeah, to the shirtless yodeling QAnon shaman running around and trying to overthrow the government by just thinking about it real hard in his blinkered mind. I mean, he thought that it later was stated in court proceedings that the QAnon shaman thought that he was being mind controlled from outer space.
Yes.
That seems about on par with
just as the Confederate generals did, right? Didn't they have the same? Yeah.
Pretty much the same.
Yeah. Okay.
To be true to the radical promise of democracy. That is why Lincoln says at the battlefield at Gettysburg that the question before the nation is whether a nation of, by, and for the people can long endure. It is a test whether the thing can last. And that's in a category of itself in American history, the Civil War and the death and misery. But this is the gravest political crime since secession.
Oh, my God. I love that. He realizes, I think, how ridiculous he sounds. So he says, yeah, okay, so the Civil War, right? That's in a category of its own in terms of, like, the death toll and all the suffering. Okay, but this January 6th is the biggest thing since then, and therefore it's comparable, and therefore let's equate the two.
I think it's giving him too much credit to assume that he's conceding that the comparison is ridiculous. I think he genuinely has to believe it on some level, hence his profound psychic gratification about supposedly being vindicated for the thing that he's fixated on in the past 2.5 years. But remember, what is he referring to? What is he saying is the worst crime since secession? It was a temporary interruption of a legislative proceeding in Congress that had no bearing on the supposedly peaceful transfer of power, which was never interrupted in the first place. And the only person who was actually violently killed pursuant to this event was actually one of the Trump supporters, Ashley Babbitt, who was shot at point blank range in the throat and killed.
Yeah,
That's what he's saying is the gravest political crime since 1861.
Oh, my God. I mean, I can think of, for example, the killing of Fred Hampton. I mean, there's a million examples, an actual political crime, an actual abuse of authority with real consequences.
How about just all the examples of presidents using deceit to bring the country into war or to escalate wars?
Yeah,
like, why is that not a political crime that occurs to Chris Hayes as being on the order of January 6th? Like, January 6th is just above and beyond. Like, even just, let's just go in the past 20 years, not Iraq. Yeah. I mean, Chris Hayes was the Washington editor of The Nation when that was going on.
He came of age during that time. I mean, he was. That's why I know of him. It was during that period of against the Bush administration. Anyway, do we have to watch any more of this clip, or can we take ourselves out of?
No, you get the idea.
Okay, all right. So let's do one more, and this is just kind of a throwback to Mueller time when Robert Mueller was all of a sudden everyone's crush, and there were these fawning profiles of him and the New Yorker style section and Vogue magazine about how stylish and handsome he was. So now Jack Smith is the new, you know, white prosecutor filling the role of going after Trump. And therefore he gets elevated to, you know, daddy status in a psychological sense. So this is a clip that you pulled, Michael, from CBS News talking about the heartthrob Jack Smith.
Yeah, and this is right as Trump was in the courtroom yesterday being arraigned. This was their live coverage at the moment when the most people presumably were tuned in to CBS.
Okay.
We've just been told that Donald Trump has entered the courtroom. Also in the courtroom is the special counsel, Jack Smith. And I want to spend a moment on Jack Smith because he is essentially who Donald Trump is up against in multiple of these indictments. The two, of course, the classified documents and the January 6th one. And they are sitting across from each other inside this courtroom. Jack Smith is someone who has run over and competed in over 100 triathlons. He was reportedly at one point hit when he was on his bike by a truck. And 10 weeks later, he ran another triathlon.
Sounds like he has a lot of stamina and endurance and courage. Like, because he's done over 100 triathlons.
So not only does he have legal and prosecutorial courage, he has raw physical courage, like a Roman warrior or something who chased down the insurrectionary hordes back, you know, 2,000, 4,000 years ago or whatever to defend the Roman Empire. That's what they're likening him to. I mean, like he's riding a chariot with like a flame and like, you know, something like that. That's what it sounds like.
Oh, man.
This is a man of a lot of grit and a lot of determination.
Yes.
And even what we have seen in these indictments is just a sliver of what they know and his prosecutorial team knows, right?
His aggressive approach to his personal health and exercise correlates to how he approaches his prosecution and his strategy. We've talked a lot about how the former president is under pressure, but Jack Smith is also under pressure today.
And that's Robert Costa, right? That's like their chief Washington correspondent. His approach to his personal health mirrors his legal strategy.
Chief Washington correspondent. He's often a fill-in host on Face the Nation, the flagship Sunday morning show. Actually started at the National Review, believe it or not. People may forget. He's just smitten. I mean, but think about what they did there. I mean, it's easy and necessary to laugh scoffingly at the idolization of Jack Smith, which they've done, you know, now for just the latest iteration of this kind of idolatry, right, with Mueller and so forth. But they said, okay, now let's talk a little bit about Jack Smith. And the only details they gave were about his noble, like, personal habits, exercise. Yeah, I'm assuming he has the right diet. He probably, you know, is very caring with his wife and children.
Yes.
You know, he's a fastidious, like a reader of novels. I don't like, they gave nothing about his actual legal background or what he's done as a prosecutor, as if that's irrelevant.
Which apparently is actually not that impressive from but I don't know.
No, I mean, it's far from not being impressive. Number one, I mean, maybe the most egregious is that he was responsible. Or he was one of the line prosecutors for the prosecution of John Edwards, which fell apart.
Which is relevant to Trump's Stormy Daniels case, because that's about hush, like how you categorize hush money payments.
Right. Well, that's why it had that particular offense had to be prosecuted on a state level by the Manhattan District Attorney. That's not being prosecuted in federal court.
Right. Yeah.
So you can claim like different precedents are operative.
Right.
He prosecuted Bob McDonnell, who the governor of Virginia. Republican governor of Virginia on supposed bribery grounds. He concocted a new theory of criminal conspiracy to prosecute Bob McDonnell. And then once it finally reached the Supreme Court unanimously vacated the conviction. So everybody from Ruth Bader Ginsburg to Clarence Thomas agreed that the conviction of Bob McDonnell had been unconstitutional. Now, I don't know like what constitutes as like a really egregious offense for a prosecutor or something that could like dampen your prosecutorial star, but that probably seems like maybe one of them. Even if you go back further, he was a prosecutor in New York State, a federal prosecutor in New York State, and he was reprimanded by a judge so resoundingly that the judge had threw out the death penalty conviction of a guy in Staten Island who had been found guilty of murdering two NYPD detectives. Jack Smith's misconduct in the sentencing phase of that particular proceeding was seen as so egregious by the judge that he set aside the death penalty conviction of a convicted cop murderer. Which means it has to have been pretty bad.
Well, maybe these judges weren't aware of his triathlon record.
Another thing, though, Aaron, is that this really should be seen as damaging in light of the incredulity that it betrays about how the media is covering these prosecutions. Like, if all we need to know about Jack Smith and the prosecution writ large is that he has these really relatable personal characteristics, then you don't have to look into whether there had been any undue political influence in bringing about the prosecutions. You don't have to question whether there were political factors that gave rise to the bringing of the charges, whether in this case or in the classified documents case. Joe Biden is just is completely beyond reproach, apparently, even though the New York Times reported that he had privately reprimanded Merrick Garland, for not aggressively prosecuting Trump enough. Not going at hard enough after Trump. And then they leaked it to the New York Times through confidants. And, all of a sudden the supposedly private comments were no longer private and influence is exerted on the attorney general. Like none of that bears any investigation because all we need to know is that there's this glorious, corrupt, untainted prosecutor who's going to save democracy for us.
Yes. And meanwhile, when Trump would call for prosecuting his political opponents, that was a threat to democracy. So another case where the standard.
If Trump just sniffed in the direction of the Department of Justice, then it was that day's meltdown where we had to all run around about how we were being overtaken by fascism. But there's even a long Washington Post article that came out fairly recently where they have sources who say outright that political pressure exerted on the Justice Department is what led to the department pursuing January 6th related charges against Trump that there was initially some resistance to bringing because of the potentially grave implications given Trump's role as like the standard bearer of the Republican Party. But we don't need to look into that any further or with any degree of skepticism because although we were all supposed to be in a constant panic about anything that Trump tweeted that could be interpreted as potentially reflecting undue political influence exerted on the Justice Department. Now it's just a blank slate or just a free rein for anybody who wants to do anything against Trump. They resurrected the Espionage Act.
Yeah,
they're charging Trump. They're charging Trump.
Hear that? Yeah.
Yeah, they're charging Trump under the same statute that they charged Assange, Manning, Snowden, Ellsberg, etc. with, and that's just supposed to be completely normal.
And the last thing I want to say on this is that, again, I mean, the fact that this is so easily called an insurrection, a coup, and when you compare this to actual coups where people lose their lives, where the military is involved, where all the things that go into a coup actually happen, as opposed to this, which is you have a three-hour riot and you have the QAnon shaman pretending to be the leader for a few minutes. We're supposed to take all this as comparable. And meanwhile, these same people get up and cheer Juan Guaido when he comes into their chamber as he's trying to lead an insurrection in Venezuela, which they're all supporting. And that's one of the many reasons why I cannot take any of this stuff seriously. And Michael Tracy, you've given us so many more. So I'm very grateful to you for joining us today. Anything more you want to leave us with?
Yeah, just quickly. I mean, to your point there, one of the ironies is that the principal reason why it was so ridiculous for Trump and MAGA supporters to be hyping January 6th in the first place, prior to it coming, was they had basically woven together a nonsensical new theory of their own, which is that the symbolic or ceremonial legislative proceeding that takes place on January 6th was somehow outcome determinative of who wins the presidential election. I mean, nobody had ever really even entertained that as a viable theory before, because according to the Constitution, or according to like a plain reading of the Constitution, once the Electoral College convenes, which it already had by January 6th for a number of weeks, and elects the next president, as they had with Joe Biden, then that's it. I mean, it's not as though like the vice president all of a sudden like gets this weird veto power over the state's certification of their electoral votes. So it was kind of ridiculous for them to puff it up in importance in the way that they did. But then, ironically, the anti-Trump crowd has also puffed up the significance of January 6th to say that the actual fate of the government itself was on the line in that legislative proceeding. Meaning if Pence had succumbed to the pressure that was being imposed on him by Trump, that would have overthrown the government. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. I mean, the actual power vested in the state power is vested in the members of Congress, who whatever building they happen to be in can convene in a parliamentary sense and conduct business. So that they've assigned all this like weird quasi mystical importance to January 6th in the same sort of way that the Trump supporters initially did. Mm-hmm. And they liken it to actual coups that do take place around the world. It was funny. I was just refreshing my memory today because, if you recall, like 3 weeks or so after January 6th of 2021, there was a genuine military coup in Myanmar, mm-hmm. where a military junta seized power, deposed the elected leaders, and dissolved the existing framework of government and began ruling the country with an iron fist. You know, thousands of civilians were killed, according to various organizations. And these kind of self-aggrandizing, fantastically like over-exaggerating liberals view January 6th, which was essentially a goofball mob intrusion that was quick dispersed within about 2 or 3 hours. They liken that in their imagination to actual military coups that take place. So they see themselves as comparably victimized as the people in Myanmar or recently in Niger in Africa, who are being cracked down upon by like literal military juntas that seize power. They think they think that just entering the capital, which had been and violating COVID restrictions that had been in place at the time, that's a coup on the order of a military junta actually like dissolving a country's constitution and taking over the functions of the state. That's the level of delusion that they've reached.
Michael Tracy is on Twitter at mtracy and also writes on Substack at mtracy.substack.com. Michael, thanks so much for taking the time to join us today. It was great to talk to you.
All right. As enjoyable as ever. And I know I see you're laughing, but I couldn't be more sincere. I mean, look at my face.
This is a solemn week.
Yes, yeah, let's reflect on the magnitude of this moment.
Yes, let's reflect on the let's follow Chris Hayes' lead and reflect. Yeah. All right, Michael, thanks so much for joining us. Good to see you.
All right.
Bye.
You've been listening to Gray Zone Radio and a conversation between Max Blumenthal, Aaron Mate, and Michael Tracy about the Trump indictments. Thanks for joining us in this episode. Visit the Gray Zone's website at www.thegrayzone.com to sign up for our newsletter to be alerted about future live streams and to read some of the best independent reader-supported journalism that you can find online. You can also follow us on YouTube, Instagram, Twitter, and Telegram. Thanks for tuning in. I've been your co-host and producer of the show, Chris Weaver.
Pacifica's elections are underway for delegates to the local station board. Ballots go out August 15th. Here are two candidate statements. Others will air throughout the day.
I am Edward Fakes. Yes, my real name. Born in Los Baños, California. I was first introduced to KPFK by a lady friend who constantly listens to it. I learned to appreciate the station by osmosis. I want to be with good forces that will guarantee that KPFK 90.7 FM will continue to open the hearts of those who want a world that works for all of us, not just the privileged few. My living experience would be an asset to the board and collectively, with all, to serve the best needs of the station. Thank you for your vote. Edward Fakes.
Hi, my name is Kelly Flores, and I am running for the KPFK Local Station Board because I am dedicated to helping the station continue to thrive and keeping it strong with listener support and programming for the people. I'm committed to finding sustainable options for the radio powered by the people and to grow the progressive grassroots programming by and for the working class and Indigenous people of color. Over the past several years, so many changes have negatively impacted the station, and I want to help turn that around. We have financial constraints, and we need to find a better and more creative ways to fundraise, increase membership and listener support, as well as update and innovate our technology. I want to help do this. Please consider voting for me, Kelly Flores, to KPFK's local station board. Thank you.
You just heard from two candidates for KPFK's local station board. All candidate statements and information about the voting process are at elections.pacifica.org. Pacifica's elections are underway for delegates to the local station board. Ballots go out August 15th. Here are two candidate statements. Others will air throughout the day.
Hello, I'm Sonny Lloyd, longtime history teacher and socialist activist in Los Angeles. In 2022, I ran for LA City Council with the goal of breaking the corporate power over our city government. Now I'm running for KPFK board with the same goal of breaking the corporate takeover of this radio station. I bring with me years of union and community activist experience on behalf of the working class and the poor. I fight for civil liberties, including medical freedom and the end of the police state and mass surveillance. I fight for racial, gender, and economic justice, in truth, in media. Build the worker state, resist fascism, vote Lloyd for KPFK board. Thank you.
Asked by friends to run for KPFK board. First response, I don't need this sh-. Second response, I cannot imagine my life without Pacifica. So here I am. Tatanka, Kit Bricka, my name. Vietnam draft resistor, UFW organizer, trained personally by Dolores Huerta, coordinated San Francisco Bay Area grape, wine, lettuce boycotts, co-founded Amnesty International West Coast with Joan Baez and Janetta Sagan, an L.A. Amnesty chapter with Lonnie Hall and Herb Grossman, co-founded Business Partnership for Peace of Ben and Jerry, co-founded Circle 100 with Danny Ishii and Sarah Nelson, a Romero Institute. I work with them and Dolores right now on creating a progressive government waiting, and we support Lakota people. Together, Si Se Puede, dynamic programming and robust fundraising for KPFK and Pacifica, asking for your vote. Viva free speech and democracy. Gracias, Tatanka.
You just heard from two candidates for KPFK's local station board. All candidate statements and information about the voting process are at elections.pacifica.org.
Hey, this is Wanda Sykes, and you're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles. And if you'd like to shell out a few bucks, you know, keep us up and running so I can have nice conversation in a cool voice like this. Pick up the phone and call 818-985-5735. That's 818-985-KPFK. Thank you.